This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this show, Ambassador for Time to Change, Alistair Campbell, will tell us why he's learned to play Havanagila on the bagpipes. No, I'm not kidding. Dr. Dana Atsil, Senior Lecturer at the Psychology Department at the Bar-Ilan University, tells us how AI is helping to treat people with depression. Chief Executive of Jamie, Laurie Rackhind, chats about the importance of Mental Health Awareness Week. And Alex Stefney, founder and CEO of the charity Beam, talks about a new way of helping those who are homeless. But before all of that, let's start off this edition of the JN Podcast, like we usually do, with a look through your copy of the Jewish news for this week. And joining me to go through it is, well, normally I'd say editor Richard Ferrer, but instead I'm going to say guest editor Johnny Benjamin, MBE. We'll find out why in just a moment. And news editor Justin Cohen. Welcome to the both of you. Now, on the front page, the headline reads Changing Minds, and then there's a little subheading, The Mental Health Issue, edited by Johnny Benjamin. Now, Johnny, I have to ask you, what was it like editing a newspaper? Have you ever done that before?
No, funnily enough, I haven't. And actually, yeah, I'm now a full-time editor. Richard's gone. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, it was nice while it lasted.
Well, yeah.
I wish Richard all the best.
Exactly. So,
do tell us the reason behind, obviously, that you have edited this paper this week is because, in case people weren't aware, it is Mental Health Awareness Week. And so, of course, you were approached to edit the Jewish news for this week in commemoration of that. So what would you say some of the highlights are of what you had to do as guest editor?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, I was really touched to be asked. It all happened very, very quickly, but it was amazing, actually. What I found was, well, we just had so much content. There's so much to talk about. Mental health is such a complex issue with so many kind of facets to it. And it was, I mean, what I felt very privileged, actually, to be sitting in the, obviously not sitting in person because we're in lockdown, but sitting online in the editorial meetings, talking with the other journalists who've all done fantastically, I have to say, this week. I feel like I might have put the pressure on with all the things that I was suggesting them to look at. But I think what's come out of it, hopefully, is, well, I mean, just the front page itself. I absolutely love the front page, the image and the words, Changing Minds, because that's what it's all about, is changing minds. You know, we are all very much more aware of mental health, but, you know, I don't think we ever really go into it too in depth. Whereas this issue of the Jewish news very much goes into mental health in depth. And I think most of all, what I'm really kind of proud of is shows how well we're doing in the Jewish community in terms of actually changing minds and making a difference. There's so many positive stories in the Jewish news this week of individuals that are doing incredible work, organizations that are truly helping people that are struggling with their mental health. So it's been really, really positive, the process. And I feel really proud. And I hope the people, readers, will take a lot away from it this week.
Well, I suppose now's the ideal time to bring in Justin, who, of course, is one of the more regular editors of the paper, news editor, in fact. Justin, how did Johnny fare? You're welcome to rate him.
Oh, no. Please be nice.
Well, I'd have to say 10 out of 10. And I mean that. I think I asked Johnny if he would take up the reins and sit in the hot seat for this week only 7 days ago. And here we are with a 60-page issue of the newspaper, one we're very, very proud of. And he really threw himself into doing this job. Not that he had a particularly quiet week as it was. He wasn't twiddling his thumbs. He managed to find the time to throw everything into this issue, to bring in a number of his contacts. Alistair Campbell, for example, has written a piece for this week's paper about...
Who, of course, we'll be speaking to later on in this very programme.
Absolutely. We've also got some very powerful, very emotive pieces from the Connick family who were touched by the suicide of their mum, and also many other very powerful, inspirational pieces of content. We look at some of the young activists who are leading the way alongside Johnny in raising awareness about mental health in the UK, not just within the community, but outside the community as well. I think what really stands out, as Johnny said, is that this might be an issue that still needs to be talked about more, and that's why Mental Health Awareness Week is so important. But whether it be in the mainstream part of the community or in the Haredi part of the community, or in terms of the community speaking to the outside world, we are doing better than ever. And one of the subjects we actually cover, obviously there's a focus in particular on this time and how the coronavirus is particularly affecting mental health. We speak to some of the well-being practitioners that were brought into schools last year by the Jewish Leadership Council, and some of their experiences, what they're doing, what they've been doing during lockdown to improve and look after children. Again, really inspirational work, cutting edge work. And yeah, as I said, I really want to pay tribute to Johnny, but also to some of the other people that made this issue possible, in particular to Jamie, the Jewish Community's Mental Health Charity, and to Dan Gore Education, who both supported this week's issue to make it what it is.
I feel like I've had the easy job this week of, you know, directing people, directing the journalists at the Jewish News to go out and interview people. I've had the easy job. You know, it's actually the journalists. I have to really pay tribute to all the journalists who have worked so hard this week for the Jewish News.
So there you go. So it's official. Richard Ferrer doesn't do very much work. It's the journalists.
I didn't say that.
In all seriousness, though, we have to look at some of the other stories that are making the paper this week, because obviously there's an awful lot about mental health, but there are some other stories as well. And let's look on page 2. We haven't delved very far. New provision for donors. Justin, this is positive news for those torn between the government's new guidelines on organ donation.
Yeah, this is a part of the paper that Johnny didn't tend to, a rare part of this week's paper. But yeah, the new law came into effect this week that moved organ donations in this country from an opt-in situation to an opt-out. So it's now assumed that people are willing to donate their organs if the time comes, unless they state otherwise. What the Chief Rabbi's Office, alongside the Board of Deputies and others, have been working for 2 years to do is to try and work out a specific provision for the Jewish community within this. And they've managed to secure a caveat, which basically enables people to go online, or it will do in 4 months' time when this comes online, and to indicate that they are people of faith, that faith means a lot to them, and that they're Jewish. And at that point, if the time comes, the healthcare authorities will be able to refer to that individual person's religious authorities to check with them whether the organ donation is something that would be permissible. The reason for this, of course, is that in Orthodox Judaism, at least, the assumption has been always that Jewish law points away from donations. And so the number of donations taking place within the community, I think, has been limited as a result of that. What this means is that the Jewish community is being really given the green light, a hechsher, if you like, to really engage in a positive way and to look at the options that exist, and they do exist, to enable Orthodox Jewish people to also donate their organs. And hopefully that means there will be an increase in the number of donations that could be made from within the community. I think it's really a very significant provision that's been put in place here. And as I said, in 4 months' time, that'll come into effect.
It certainly feels very significant, but one thing I'm quite keen for us to get in before we run out of time for the paper review for this week is the story that is actually not in the paper yet, but it will be online. JW3 making waves, not just in the Jewish community, but actually in the borough. What are they up to that's impressed you and caught your eye?
This is really an incredible story. We discovered this week that JW3 have become the hub for collections of food for the Camden borough. It all started, I understand, outside the home, outside the front door of the chief executive, Raymond Simonson, when he decided among his neighbours to start a collection of food for those who experience food poverty, who need basic provisions at this time. He decided to start this collection, and out of that has really grown further work within JW3. So they've used their model kitchen to produce food, to produce hundreds and thousands of meals for those in the wider community who are in need. But now people are actually using JW3 as a collection point, as a hub to deliver food from around the borough. So this week alone, Arsenal Foundation delivered 4.5 tons of food for the needy in the area. And I believe that's going to become a weekly delivery point. I just think that at a time when, yes, the community is pulling together to support one another, the fact that JW3 is doing this for the entire local community is, I think, the ultimate definition of a Kiddush Hashem.
I think, couldn't think of a better way to put it myself. So there you go. That's not in the paper, but that will be online from Friday. So there you go. I think that's where we'll have to leave it, though, for a look at the paper today. So to say thank you to news editor Justin Cohen and guest editor Johnny Benjamin, MBE. Thank you both very much indeed. Now, don't forget, you can pick up your copy of the Jewish News every Thursday, or if you are isolating at the moment, you'll find the full paper as it would be printed online at jewishnews.co.uk. Thank you both.
Thank you, Phil.
This is the JN Podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, here's something I never thought that I would find myself talking about, but it didn't half put a smile on my face when I found out the story behind it. If you think of Alistair Campbell, you may be forgiven for thinking of maybe broadcaster, journalist, political aide, possibly even his current role as ambassador for Time to Change, the mental health campaign. But I wonder whether or not you would associate him being a rather splendid bagpipes player. More importantly, whether or not you would have even thought it was possible to play Havana Gila on the bagpipes. No, I'm not pulling your leg. I'm being absolutely serious. I couldn't be happier to say that joining me now on the JN Podcast is Alistair Campbell himself. Don't know whether or not we've got the bagpipes present, but we'll hear a clip of that later on to speak a little more about this. Alistair, it certainly struck me as a headline, especially during a week where everyone is so focused on mental health. I just love the headline, Alistair Campbell, why I'm playing Havana Gila on my bagpipes. Why are you playing Havana Gila on your bagpipes?
Well, it's actually quite a long story. I've played the bagpipes most of my life since I was a child. I've probably been playing more in recent years than I have, partly because my dad and my brother, both of whom are pipers, they both died, and sort of just, you know, I think every time I play, I kind of keep a bit, little bit of a connection going there. Mm. Added to which, I've actually got back into the habit of practicing a fair bit. I've even been writing a bit of music again. And anyway, during roundabout now, might even been this weekend. Yes, I think it was this weekend. Georgia Gould, who is a family friend, we've known her since she was a little child. Her dad was Philip Gould, who was my closest friend in politics. Her mum's Gail Rebuck, well-known publisher.
Can we just say, sorry, that for those who don't know, Georgia Gould is obviously of Camden Council, sorry.
She's the leader of the Camden Council, indeed. And she was meant to be getting married this weekend. Way back, a few months, she said, I bet you couldn't. She wanted me to do a speech at the wedding, and she wanted me to play the bagpipes at the wedding. And she said, I bet you can't do Havana Gila. So I said, well, go and sing it. And the reason I said that was not because I didn't know the tune. And actually, Georgia's a terrible singer. She won't mind me saying that. She's really bad. But anyway, the range of the bagpipe is actually quite limited. It's 10 notes max.
Wow.
One octave, really, that you're playing with. So I was amazed when I checked Havana Gila. It actually does fit within the bagpipe scale. What's more, I then looked on Google, and there's lots of stuff of there. People played Havana Gila on bagpipes, and I found sheet music as well.
My goodness, what, for the bagpipes?
For the bagpipes.
Oh, fabulous, look at that.
Yeah.
Terrific.
So it was quite easy to learn. I learned it. And then the next thing was that this is what I've written at Jewish News. I've been playing every week at the 8 p.m. clap. So we go out to clap the NHS and the carers. And a few doors down is a guy called Morris, who lives with his wife, Valerie. And they're both Jewish, as George and Alex are Jewish. And I was playing, I can't remember what, but I just thought, oh, I bet they've never heard Havana Gila on the bagpipes. So I just started playing it, and Morris was absolutely blown away by it.
Well, I tell you what, I think that without further ado, can we have a little snippet? Hold that thought. Let's have a little snippet of you playing Havana Gila on the bagpipes, because I think this is terrific. I love this.
stay in here.
How brilliant is that? How long did it take you to learn?
Not long. It's a very, it's a simple tune. The thing about bagpipes, though, is that most instruments, well, not most instruments, a lot of instruments, you can play them with the music in front of you, which makes it a lot easier. The thing with bagpipes is, especially if you kind of, you know, march up and down the street on a Thursday night where people are clapping the NHS, you've got to memorize it. And no, it's quite a simple tune. It's quite a simple tune.
I love it. I thought that sounded fantastic. Anyway, good. I tell you what, now I really want to get in before we run out of time to talk a little bit about Time to Change, because it's a mental health campaign that you are an ambassador for. And so why not take this opportunity during Mental Health Week on the JM podcast to tell people a little bit about Time to Change and what it stands for?
Well, it's a mental health awareness campaign. It's about trying to break down stigma and taboo surrounding mental health. It's been going now for 14 years, I think it is, and I think is having a significant impact. It's got backing from the government, it's got backing from COVID relief, it's got backing from the lottery, and it really is just about trying to change the way that people think and talk about mental health. And there's no doubt it is changing. I think we are going to be in for a very, very rough ride on this coronavirus pandemic. I think that if you just think about all of the different aspects of it, you know, we talk about the frontline workers. Well, you know, they are seeing and they're dealing with pressures that I think you can expect to, you know, at least some to exhibit PTSD type symptoms. You can see, I think, the way that people are dealing with this illness and not able to be with their families. I think people who are losing loved ones to death, all of these things. And then, of course, maybe even worse than all that is going to be the economic impact of this.
Do you know what? I fear that all of these things you are saying are sadly very true. And I dare say that you and I could talk about this for a very long time. But there's one thing I must cram in. We want to remind people that you have written a piece for the Jewish News and that they should go to the Jewish News website if they want to read that. But in particular, you're writing about kindness, as requested by Johnny Benjamin, who has edited the Jewish News this week, as we heard earlier on in the programme. I want to know what kindness is to you. Can you try and summarise that for us?
Well, the specific thing I wrote about in the piece was it was in relation to music and how actually you can display kindness through music and through what you do with your music. But I think kindness for me is thinking about other people in a very kind of practical way. I don't just mean thinking about other people. One of the things that's driving me crazy about this pandemic is these, you know, when the government sort of trots out the statistics and then says, you know, our thoughts and prayers are, and that is, it just feels so kind of formulaic. I think real kindness, real empathy is about thinking about them and thinking, well, actually, what do they need right now? How can I help them right now? When you look around your neighborhood and you just worry about other people. You think, I wonder how so-and-so is getting on, and then you go and do something about it.
Well, as I say, you can find Alistair Campbell in the Jewish News this week. Article very simply headed, Alistair Campbell, why I'm playing Hava Nagila on my bagpipes. It is worth a read. I think it's terrific.
I'm not playing it all the time, you know.
You're not playing it all the time, no. But you played it a bit, and I tell you what, I love it, and I think it's fantastic. Good. As are you, sir. Thank you very much indeed
for taking
the time to speak to us on the JN podcast.
All
Alistair
the best.
Campbell.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for our community. Now, when you think of treatments for depression and other conditions that can absolutely overrule some people's lives, you don't necessarily think of turning to technology. But anyone who knows me and what I do will know that this brings together two of the fields in which I'm quite passionate about, technology being one of them, and also mental health and well-being being another. So the fact that we could turn to technology for this blows my mind. Well, it's being developed in the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, and I'm so pleased to say that joining us now is Senior Lecturer at the Psychology Department at the Bar-Ilan University. That's Dr. Dana Atzil. Dr. Adsils, first and foremost, I mean, I have to say, very scarcely am I lost for words, as you can probably tell. But I was reading this article about the work that you are doing, and I have to say, it left me absolutely dumbfounded. This is incredible, isn't it?
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to hear that you're passionate about it. I'm also very, very passionate about it. And it's not obvious. I mean, to bring together researchers from the computer science department and clinical psychologists is not something that you do every day. And I'm very, very happy that it's starting to get shape and that we're starting to collaborate. And I'll be very happy to tell you about our project.
Well, what a good idea. Let's start off then at the beginning, the idea, the genesis of the idea. What was it that made you or your colleagues suddenly think of, okay, maybe the key to treating depression is artificial intelligence? What is it that a computer could learn that, say, a psychologist couldn't?
So, yeah, I can start with the problem. I mean, I think that you must know that depression is a very, very big problem in the modern world. Approximately 264 million people around the world are affected and suffer from major depression disorder. And this is an epidemic. One in of each five women and one in each 10 men suffer from depression. It's even more common in the physically ill. It can start in any age. It's chronic. There is an 80% reoccurrence. And so, yeah, many, many people suffer in the modern world, and it's on the rise. We know that in 10 years, it's going to be number one health burden in the modern world. And in the recent decades, there have been many treatments for depression, medications and psychotherapy, CBT, psychodynamic treatments. These treatments are effective, but we also know that approximately 50% of the people who are getting treatment do not experience real improvement. They only experience partial improvement. And this is a problem. This is not good enough. And we know that artificial intelligence and personalized treatment has started to be very dominant in other fields of medicine. And we believe that the mental health field should go at the same direction. And we think that technology can help.
Right. Well, in that case, let's have a look at how the actual process works. So let's say a client has depression, and you are going to use artificial intelligence in order to help that client. Now, I recognize that it's obviously got to be very personalized for the individual, but can you give us an overall, a broad picture of how that technology would treat that particular client?
Well, our intention is not that technology will treat the clients, but we know that there is a very large variability between clients in the way they react to treatment, and that there are many, many symptoms of depression, as depression is not a one disease. It's like cancer. There are many, many different symptoms, and people react to treatment and people suffer from different experiences when they say that they suffer from depression. One crucial question is what works for whom and in what moments? And there we believe that technology can help us. And our vision is to use this. We collect a very, very rich amount of data in our community clinic in Bar-Ilan University with the support of Dangour Center for Personalized Treatment, Personalized Medicine. And we see clients, hundreds of clients for many, many years. We record the session. We have audio tapes and videotapes and a lot of labeled data, a lot of self-reports and clinician assessment. We can use this data and use artificial intelligence to analyze this data in order to tell us different clusters of depression, for example. This is for diagnosis. For example, we use the voice. The voice is a very sensitive measure that can capture nuance in the client's experience and their distress and their emotional arousal. For example, in collaboration with Shirkan Narayanan from UCLA, we found out, we developed an algorithm that can integrate different aspects in the client's voice, their pitch, their energy, and the quality of their voice. And we can tell that this algorithm can capture the personalized aspect of this combination of a client. They can tell, for example, if you know someone, right, the human brain can tell you that something is changing, and our algorithm is able actually to capture these nuances, to integrate different aspects of the human voice, their pitch, the quality of their voice, their energy, and to tell whether someone is getting better or deteriorating. And this is something that can help us to make a better diagnosis over time. We also use text. There are many, many words in clients' session, and we use automatic transcription, and we analyzed with natural language processing expert, we analyzed the text in the client's session. We use the text, the voice, the facial expression to capture changes in the client's experience and to use clusters. That is also something that artificial intelligence help us with, to capture clusters of different manifestations of depression. So then we can, you know, allocate clients to treatment. This is only at the beginning of treatment. You don't need to send someone to CBT treatment or to give them medication for 3 months and then learn that it doesn't help them. We have a lot of data, thousands of sessions. We can analyze retrospectively these sessions and the outcome of treatment, and we can see whether we could have known at the beginning of treatment that this client, based on their voice, on their text, on their facial expression, would benefit from this treatment or from a different treatment.
Donna, I have to tell you, I could talk to you about this indefinitely, and it seems so wrong of me to stop you here, because frankly, I find it absolutely riveting, totally fascinating, and it seems so wrong to ask you to summarize countless hours of work and research into a matter of minutes. But there, I'm so sorry, we must leave it. But thank you so, so much for speaking to me on the JN podcast. It's truly amazing, and seriously, best of luck with the research as it continues.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to talk with you, and I'll be happy to tell more details about our research and about our plans for the future. So thank you. Thanks a lot.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. And speaking of mental health charity for the community, what better way to understand exactly what Mental Health Awareness Week means to us as a community by speaking to Chief Executive of Jamie, that is, of course, Laurie Rackhind. And I am most delighted to say that he joins us now. Laurie, I can't even begin to imagine what a busy week this must be for you. So thank you, first and foremost, for taking time out to speak to us. Can we just maybe start off with that? What is Jamie up to or has been up to this week?
Well, thank you very much, Phil. It's a pleasure to speak with you. In any normal time, I would agree with you that Mental Health Awareness Week would be a peak in our activities. But during a global pandemic, I would not say that it has been. And we've been working frenetically, I would say, 24/7 since the pandemic hit. And I'm just very proud and delighted that we were still able to do an awful lot of good stuff for this week. And the team's really stepped up, even though an awful lot of colleagues have been redeployed to frontline services.
Can we unpick then how exactly it differs from, say, a normal, forgive the expression, but a normal mental health awareness week? So one where we're not overwhelmed with the COVID-19 outbreak. What is it that you guys would normally do versus what you've been doing this year?
Okay, well, I think, as I said, I'm proud to say that I think we've been doing an awful lot, arguably even more. Clearly, it's all done virtually on various digital platforms. And the beauty of what we've been able to do this year is because we've brought it all onto digital platforms, arguably we're going to reach an awful lot more people that we would do in a traditional year. Now, the point I'm making is that it doesn't seem a peak in activity given the level that we've been operating at for the last few weeks.
How does this impact the COVID-19 outbreak? How does it impact on Jamie's everyday services? Because I know you're here to talk about Mental Health Awareness Week. We'll unpick that in just a bit. But I want to look at how it is affecting what you guys do on an everyday basis as well, because a lot of what Jamie does is about face-to-face contacts, you know, whether it's from Headroom Cafe, whether it is the services that you provide at the main center. All of these different services that you guys provide require people to be face-to-face. And I can't help but think that with social distancing, that must make it nearly impossible.
Yeah. And apologies for correcting you. We don't like using the word social distancing. We prefer to use physical distancing because that's what it is. And I guess our priority is to make sure that social links and social networks are put in place or maintained during this period because they're really, really important. You're right that an awful lot of the stuff that we were doing, certainly pre-COVID, was face-to-face. What we did is immediately the pandemic struck, we identified, at any one time we're working with between 12 and 1,300 people. We did a risk assessment to make sure we'd identified those people that were most at risk amongst people using our services. And there were probably best part of 400 names that came out on that list. And then the challenge was to make sure that we could stay in contact with them and provide meaningful support. So we had to identify those people that had telephones, had IT, had Wi-Fi, and those that didn't, we had to make sure that we put that in place. So very quickly, we procured a load of tablet computers with SIM cards, because as I said, people didn't have Wi-Fi, and started the not insignificant process of trying to set a lot of people up who had not previously had any use of IT or tech. So we put remote support in place, all sorts of things in place. And from that point on, once we'd done that infrastructural piece, it's that much easier to stay in contact with people. So we identified which people needed the one-to-one support and which people group support would still an acceptable alternative, although I must say an awful lot of people are doing both. We also identified which people from those using our hubs particularly really relied on our hubs for what might be their only one or two hot meals of the week. So we started producing the cafe, which you kindly referred to. We redeployed the chefs from the cafe to start producing food for those people most in need, started delivering the food and having doorstep chat. And what we found is, I guess, not surprisingly, the food wasn't the most important element to it. The doorstep chat was. So even though in some respects we would have been able to coordinate with other organisations who were able to deliver the food, it was important that we kept our own staff and volunteers doing those doorstep chats to make sure that we remained in contact with our service users, that kind of vital intervention. And there have been various safeguarding issues, various health issues that have been highlighted because we've been able to visit people and see people face to face and recognising issues as soon as practically possible.
So what we can surmise from all of this is that you guys haven't really been up to that much.
Absolutely. I wish. Yeah, absolutely. It has been. It's really quite bizarre. My wife's an NHS worker. She's a director over
there. Bravo. Yeah. Now, do you know what, Laurie? I have to tell you that one thing that really delights me but also saddens me as well is that sort of something that Mental Health Awareness Week has done is raise the awareness of the work that you guys do for the community. But what saddens me is that people have not necessarily been aware of Jamie as long as they probably could have and should have been. And the reason why I say that is because I think that as a community, we have this horrible habit of burying our heads in the sand and almost denying that mental health could possibly affect any of us. Because it's a bit like keeping up with the Goldsteins, if you will, how we always have to put on this front of everything's lovely, everything's great, my family are doing really well for themselves. We've put the most terrible pressure on ourselves as a community. And as a result of that pressure, I fear that organizations and services such as the ones that Jamie provide fall by the wayside because we don't necessarily associate them with ourselves. But of course, Mental Health Awareness Week has hopefully changed that a bit.
No, I think you're right. And I think actually it's even worse than you describe, in the sense that the Jewish community does recognize the importance of mental health in terms of the number of Jewish clinical professionals there are, as psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, et cetera, et cetera. So we clearly as a community see it as really important and indeed have chosen that as our profession in quite a lot of cases, but don't recognise that it affects us. And I think that's the issue. And I think there will be hopefully some positives to come out of the pandemic, and possibly now is not the time to talk about those particularly. But I think one positive has been that mental health has become almost a parallel conversation with the virus itself. And I think hopefully as we come through this, that's going to be really helpful because it will bring it up. We talk about parity of esteem. We talk about the importance of mental health being considered on the same platform, if you like, as the risk of physical health. That hasn't been the case. And I think, unfortunately, what's going to happen is even when we start, you know, we talk about curves all the time when we've been talking about the pandemic, even as we're on the way down the curve in terms of the viral impact, the mental health impact, we are still on the upward trajectory. And I think our concern is, as an organisation, as a community, it should be the community's concern that there is an increasing demand on mental health services. The mental health needs of the community will go up. And I just hope that it doesn't spike to beyond the point where the community and organisations like Jamie can really cope.
Well, do you know what? Thank goodness for you and thank goodness for Jamie. And if anyone does want any more information on where they go to find out about the services that Jamie provides, and more importantly, if they feel that they could benefit from any of those services, please do tell us where we go.
And probably the most important place to go just to get all this information is our website, jamiuk.org. All sorts of information there. You can even make referrals for yourself or someone that has given permission for you to make a referral on their behalf through that website. We've taken our whole referral process online, and even if you call the main Jamie number, which is 0208 458 2223, you'll be taken through to an electronic voicemail system that attaches an MP3 file to emails that will be sent out to the duty team. So either route will get in touch, but there's all sorts of awareness stuff. You mentioned the cafe earlier. I would encourage people to get involved with the cafe program. All the things that were going on in the cafe are still going on. They're just not taking place in the physical space of the cafe.
Laurie Rackhind, you and your team are superhuman as far as I'm concerned, not just for Mental Health Awareness Week, but all the year round. Thank you so much for not just speaking to me on the JN podcast, but for everything you do for the community. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much indeed. Pleasure to speak with you, Bill.
This is the JN podcast in association with Jamie, the mental health charity for the community. Now, obviously, given these times of COVID-19, I think that many of us would be forgiven for putting ourselves first and not necessarily thinking about the needs of others. Make no mistake, there are plenty out there who are doing it all the same. And in particular, there's one organisation that is putting the needs of those who are homeless at the forefront of what they do. The organisation is BEAM, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now by the founder and CEO, Alex Stephanie. So let's find out a little more about what they do. And Alex, I think we should start off first and foremost with that. For those who may not have heard of BEAM, why not give us a little bit of background as to what the organisation is for?
BEAM is a completely new way to help a homeless person for the long term. And how does that work? Well, anyone out there can crowdfund their employment training, and then we support that individual through that training and all the way into stable, skilled work. And that can mean anything from being a bricklayer to an accountant. And this all got started about 3 years ago now when I became friends with a homeless person at my tube station. And I would buy this man cups of coffee and pairs of socks, but I could see his condition just deteriorating really in front of my eyes. And one day he disappeared for about 7 or 8 weeks. And then when he reappeared, he looked so much worse. And I went up to him and I said, "Where have you been?" And he said, "Been in hospital. I had a heart attack." And it hit me really hard that what this man needed was really the skills and the support to provide for himself. And really, that's what BEAM is doing. It's allowing the public to make really smart investments in the futures of people who are homeless, supporting them to get the skills that they need to provide for themselves, but also to provide for their families.
Now, I don't wish for this next question to sound as callous as it may come across, but I think it is a fair point. There are many hundreds, if not thousands, if tens of thousands of commuters who on a daily basis in ordinary times would make their way to work and walk past endless people who are homeless and possibly not give, well, much of a hoot about them, to be frank. Why did it matter so much to you? Because that's where I think we really will find the difference between many of us and your good self.
Well, I think that the homelessness that we see on the streets is, I guess, the most sort of visible form of inequality in the UK in many ways. You know, we've become very necessarily hard-hearted in some ways because, you know, we can't break down in tears every single time we see someone who's homeless, unfortunately. And it is something that, you know, is hardwired to affect us because, you know, it's so obviously wrong that in a country as wealthy as the UK, people having to sleep on the streets. However, one of the things I realized when I first started looking at this area was that actually for every one person we see on the streets, there are about 30 people who live in homeless hostels or other types of emergency accommodation. So there's this much larger group who do actually have a roof over their heads. It's not really a home in the sense that you or I would think of it, Phil, but they have the basics in place. And this group, the largest group there, is mostly, in fact, single mothers and kids. And this is the group that Beam is most focused on. It's people in this homeless emergency accommodation. There's about 290,000 people in this emergency accommodation in the UK. And our job, working with the community of supporters who are crowdfunding their training, is to empower this group to get the skills that they need to get into work and move out of this problem for good.
And you see, half of the battle, because I know, based on myself having approached people who are on the streets in particular, less so of the situations you are talking about. But for myself, having approached people who do appear to have nowhere to go and are living on the streets as a result of it, they can only be helped if A, they don't find your approach insulting, and B, they actually want to receive that help. There must be an awful lot of hurdles to overcome in terms of trying to help somebody. If someone was to receive your help, can you talk us through that process?
Sure. So let me explain a little bit how the model works, because it's a very collaborative one that works with lots of different groups. So the first stage in the process is that we take a referral of an individual for the service from one of our partner organizations. And those partners are often homelessness charities like Shelter or St. Mungo's, or they are local authorities. And so what's happened there is someone on the front line of a service has a relationship with someone and they know that, you know, John would like to become a plumber or Mary would like to become a carpenter or whatever it is. And they then refer those individuals to us. The individual then meets a member of our team who builds a career plan for them. That career plan then becomes a campaign on beam.org. Then the public come along and they donate, and most of the donations are actually monthly donations. So we have about 1,100 people a month who are giving each month, and we actually automatically allocate those monthly donations out. And then the team at Beam support that individual through that training, whatever it may be, and into work. So this is a very collaborative framework. Homeless charities and local authorities are referring. The public is crowdfunding, training centers are providing the training, and then companies are doing the hiring. So it's a pretty far cry from just sort of, you know, running up to someone and trying to help them. And originally, that was my instinct. But actually, I thought, well, this guy outside my tube station, sure, he needs proper funding to do something proper for his life. And there needs to be an organization that makes sure that the right money is spent, you know, on the right things for the right people at the right time, and that risk is managed, and that there's process and all of these things. But all I wanted to do as a member of the public was to make a donation to someone's, you know, that would fund someone's future. And so essentially we have built a whole operational model that does all of that heavy lifting, such that someone can go to beam.org, they can fund someone's future, support them to get a job and move beyond homelessness, and then we can do all of the hard work to make that possible. And I think, you know, a really key part of this model is keeping the public who donate up to date with the progress that the people they fund are making. And so when people donate on beam.org, they get a page and they can see on their profile page exactly who they have funded and exactly where the money went, because there's a budget on each campaign. But most importantly, they can see the progress that individual is making. They can see whether that individual is looking for a job, whether they're in a job, whether they're currently doing their training, and so on.
Well, keeping in mind that the last two questions I had up my sleeve were, can people actually track where their money that they are donating is going? You've just answered that. And I also was about to ask how people can actually get involved if they so wish to. You've answered that as well. So I would suggest that all that's left for me to do is ask you to just repeat the website one more time so people know where they can go.
The website is beam.org.
And then all that is left for me to say is, Alex Stepney, founder and CEO of Beam, bravo. What you're doing is nothing less than terrific, a great initiative, and really, best of luck with it. Thank you for speaking to us on the JM podcast.
Thank you, Phil.
And there you have it. That's where we'll have to leave it for this edition of the JN podcast. All that's left for me to do is to thank all of the guests who have appeared on this show. That is, of course, Alistair Campbell, Dr. Dana Atsill, Laurie Rackhind, and Alex Stepney. We must also remember to thank our paper team. We had guest editor for the Jewish News, Johnny Benjamin, MBE, and news editor, Justin Cohen. And in fact, we must thank Justin Cohen for producing this episode of the JN podcast. Thank you at home as well for listening. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That way you'll be able to hear any previous episode or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you on editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the JN podcast. Goodbye.